Good afternoon.
David Teclis of Morse Nichols Archie Tunnel for the Appalese. I'd just like to introduce to the court Mr. Everett Johnson, Jr. of the Latham & Watkins office. He'll be making the argument on behalf of the Appalese with the court's permission today.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. Peter Walsh on behalf of the appellant, Joseph Nemec, who is seated in the courtroom. As the court is aware, this is an appeal in two separate but consolidated cases. Both complaints share the same core allegations and claims, and for that reason, and with the court's permission, I'm going to spend about 10 minutes addressing the good faith and fair dealing claim, and then Mr. Gallagher, who represents Mr. Whitkemper, is going to speak to the breach of fiduciary duty claim for about 5 minutes, and we've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll rest on our papers for purposes of the unjust enrichment claim. The Court of Chancery dismissed the good faith and fair dealing claim based upon the reasoning that the stock plan, the officer right plan in issue, gave the company an option or redemption right, and the company was free to exercise that right when it chose or when it was most advantageous to the company. And our position is that in so ruling, the Court failed to recognize the well-pled facts that made this redemption unique to any other redemption in the history of the business. As defendants will urge the court, and as they urged the court below, they want to review the contract in isolation. They don't want to consider the circumstances, highly unique circumstances, under which the redemption occurred. Before I speak to those circumstances, let me just remind the court about what the plan says. The plan provides that after an employee, officer, stockholder is retired for 2 years, the company can redeem his shares. And in this particular case, given when Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper retired, prior to March 31, 2008, they had an absolute right to participate as stockholders in the Carlyle transaction when it came along. After that time, the company had a right, but not an obligation, to redeem any portion of their shares at any time. The point there is this was a discretionary option. They didn't have to exercise this right. More importantly, they didn't have to exercise and take back all of the shares. Moreover, if there was any doubt about whether the Booz Allen transaction was going to occur or not, they could have waited to see how it played out. We've alleged facts at great length in our complaint about the fact that there was little doubt this transaction was going to occur. It was announced in early 2008. The price was specified. The company proceeded to take concrete actions to divide the government business and the commercial business, all in recognition that this was going to happen. Now, let me speak to the unusual circumstances.
So if there had been contractual language to express how the other side should have acted, what would that language have been? In this circumstance, if there's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, you shall do this?
Well, I think that's the point. The contract didn't speak to that situation, and that's why this is unique. And I want to address the purpose of the contract because that's what's significant here. Remember, the court below said that this was the company's option, and it should be able to exercise that option when most advantageous to it. The problem here is that because of the Carlyle transaction, the stock plan was no longer serving a purpose. The purpose of the plan was to incentivize officer employees to stay on with the company. Once the company knew it was going to be sold, it had reached the end game. Think about it. What was the purpose? What purpose was served for the company as opposed to the board and the other shareholders in redeeming? As a result of the redemption, the only thing occurred was that the company paid $15 million to my client and Mr. Whitkemper, and in essence reduced the number of stockholders from 300 approximately to 298. In addition, it took out of circulation 3% of the shares. In other words, what happened here was purely an allocation question.
Well, that may be. You know, but what you've done, I think, persuasively in this courtroom and in your briefs is to argue the equities of the case, but we're concerned about the law. that is how those equities fit into the doctrine regarding the implied obligation to deal in good faith and fairly, which is a is a very limited claim, you know, under Delaware case law. So in implied obligation language, how do all those facts fit, particularly since the parties clearly negotiated an agreement under which the company had the absolute right to exercise its discretion once the two-year period passed to redeem? And they did.
Your Honor, again, and this Court has articulated, as the Court of Chancery has, the covenant requires a party in a contractual relationship from refraining from taking arbitrary or unreasonable conduct which deprives the other party of the fruits of the bargain. In fact, the Court's most recent pronouncement in the Dunlap, this Court says the covenant exists to preserve the spirit of the contract as opposed to the letter. The Court below and defendants propose precisely the opposite. They say simply because the company had this contract right, they were free to exercise it. And our point is that under the circumstances where the company was being sold, the purpose of the agreement was no longer being served. It simply became a question of who gets to be or participate in part of the Booz Allen pie.
I understand that. But can you express your position in implied contract, that is implied duty of fair dealing language? You haven't done that.
Well, Your Honor, what we're saying is that because the board stood to gain from this exercise of the company's option, they acted, we have alleged in our complaint, they have acted unfairly, unreasonably, or perhaps arbitrarily. And if I could analogize this case
you mean
to...
When you say the board, do you mean the company? The implied contract or the implied duty claim is a claim against the company only, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. And our point is that the beneficiaries of the company's option in this case was the board.
So maybe the board was unjustly enriched as a consequence, but if there was a violation of the implied covenant, it was a violation by the company.
It was, Your Honor. It was, Your Honor. And that's why we've attempted to state a good faith and fair dealing claim. If I could suggest to Your Honor to read Your Honor's decision in Gale versus Burchard, it is very difficult to distinguish this case from that case. And what happened in Gale, as Your Honor may recall, is it was a situation where the board, under the certificate of incorporation, again, a contract between the company and the stockholders, had a right to redeem preferred stock and to place a value on it. The board acted in conformity with the certificate of incorporation, just as defendants would say occurred here. However, in exercising its discretion in valuing the preferred stock, the board assigned an unfairly low price, which benefited the board because the board owned the majority of the common stock. And Justice Jacobs, in that case, there was both, as here, a good faith and fair dealing claim as well as a breach of fiduciary duty claim, and Your Honor concluded that, yes, the plaintiff had stated a claim for breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Again, it was a certificate of redemption. Again, it was a contract between the company and the stockholders, but the board took advantage of the company's contract to redeem shares in a way that were beneficial to the board. That's exactly what we have alleged here.
Is your the circumstances you're relying upon limited to the unique one where the company is being sold? Let's say, hypothetically, there's a corporate opportunity which is going to vastly increase the value of the company and the stock. In that circumstance, would there be a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing if your clients, they decided to redeem the shares, knowing that the company was going to continue in existence, but next year, this time, it would be worth twice as much?
Well, I think it's difficult to divorce the circumstances here because the board here understood this was the end game, and that the purpose of this agreement was no longer being served. Looking at it from the other side, it wasn't as if my clients, in exercising their put right, were in a similar position. Remember, the board had a fiduciary duty to my clients, to Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper, in making this decision under these circumstances. And I think that that is the important distinction which the court has to recognize. The only other comment, and I want to make this very quickly so Mr. Gallagher has a few minutes, is that we have emphasized this statement on March 10th by the CEO of the company where he said it's an easy moral decision to allow you to participate, and you will participate. And that's significant for three reasons. First, he recognized that this was going to happen. Secondly, he recognized it was a discretionary decision. They didn't have to redeem these gentlemen. And third, he recognized that, consistent with the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, it was the reasonable, morally just thing to do because these gentlemen had participated in creating the value which everybody was going to share as a result of this offer coming along.
Perhaps one of you will address this, but would the board breach any fiduciary duty to current shareholders by not redeeming the shares of your clients?
Your Honor, that I think is probably their comeback, and our answer to that is one, the decision was discretionary, so no stockholder who didn't get some value by reason of a non-redemption could have come into this court and argued that the board breached their fiduciary duty. And if the board had exercised their business judgment and sat down and said, what makes sense under these circumstances, knowing that this is going to happen, who should participate, they could have made a sound decision which allowed Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper to participate in part, in whole, in a way that could entirely be justified vis-a-vis any other stockholder. What it came down to was there was the Whitkemper, Nemec camp, and then there was the board and the other stockholders. All we know is that the board elected to make the decision that put $6 million in their pocket.
So basically your position is that as long as the board deliberated and came down one way or the other in good faith, then they would have complied with the implied covenant, but that it was error for the Court of Chancery to dispose of that claim as a matter of law, and that your side was entitled to a fact hearing.
Yes, Your Honor, and because of our well-pled allegations and under the 12b6 standard, that's exactly our position. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Hank Gallagher for Appellant Gerd Whitkemper, and I will briefly address the fiduciary duty issues. The Court of Chancery ruled on the fiduciary duty issues on three grounds, and I'll address those each. First, the Court held that the directors did not owe separate and distinct fiduciary duties to the plaintiffs. And for that proposition, as urged by the defendants, the Court below relied on Gilbert versus El Paso. However, Gilbert does not stand for the proposition urged. I would commend to the Court former Vice Chancellor Jacobs, now Justice Jacobs, statement in the Gilbert case in which the Court stated, to use an extreme example, suppose El Paso's directors had purposefully chosen to interfere with the proration position of the class solely to enable themselves to tender their shares. In such a case, can it be supposed that the directors could be heard that they had no duty to the class because members consisted of less than the entire body of shareholders? Clearly not. There are plenty of circumstances, I would submit to the Court, in which directors can breach a fiduciary duty to less than the entire body of stockholders. For example, if directors were acquiring the shares of one or two stockholders, for example, and concealed information from those stockholders in acquiring their shares, and then bought them on the cheap, and the directors themselves benefited and all the other stockholders benefited.
But the
how can
the
it be said
here in this particular case was that there was really no room for fiduciary duty analysis to have any play because this subject was covered by the contract. How do you?
Well, Your Honor, that is the third ground that I was going to adjust, but I'll go to that now. Your Honor, that was the holding in this case, and that was the holding in some of the other cases that have been cited. Some of those cases are distinguishable, and then we have other cases in which the courts have not ruled that way, and we would submit that as the better view. For example, in the Schuss case, which is a recent 2008 decision by Vice Chancellor Parsons, he held that both a contract claim and a fiduciary duty claim were sufficient to withstand a motion to dismiss under 12b-6. And the facts in that case were somewhat murky, as I would suggest that they are here. We don't exactly know how the board acted or how they supposedly delegated to the company, which is not even a delegation to a person.
That's a problem with the record, isn't it? I mean, I gather from the briefs, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it isn't clear what role, if any, the board played in the decision to redeem at that time.
It is not clear. What we do know, Your Honor, is that there was absolutely a linkage between these redemptions and the Carlyle transaction in the sense that they were both going on at the same time. The chairman of the board, the highest officer in the company, the CEO, told Joe Nemec, you will participate, and we understand that these redemptions should not be made in the context of this impending Carlyle transaction. So there was board activity, or let's say there was at least activity by members of the board, but we don't know. The defendants have said that the board did not actually vote, but yet they delegated this task to the company. Whatever that means, we don't even know what that means to delegate to the company.
Tell me if I have your position correctly. The company had a contract right to redeem the plaintiff's stock when it did, at the time that it actually redeemed it.
Correct.
However, somebody had to cause the company to make that decision to redeem.
Correct.
And there are enough facts in the complaint from which one can infer that the board perhaps was responsible for that decision, that has caused the company to make that decision. And to the extent that is the case, the board had a fiduciary duty that it had to exercise properly in causing the company to do that.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And your claim is that duty was not observed because basically the board had a conflict of interest.
And therefore, there could not be, for example, it's been argued and the court held that there was no allegation of anything other than a reasonable business justification for what happened. And, in fact, we alleged conflict of interest. This takes this case outside the business judgment rule. And, therefore, it's incumbent upon the defendants in a factual setting, in an evidentiary setting, to demonstrate that they acted in good faith. Your Honor, I think my time is up, so I will sit down unless the court has any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Your Honors, this is my first opportunity to appear in this court, and I thank you for the privilege. There are two bedrock principles in Delaware law which are utterly dispositive in this case. The first is that where the conduct in question is governed by contract, and I submit that's undisputed in this case, that fiduciary duty analysis no longer plays any role. It's an important principle applicable in all cases and dangerous to abandon. The second is that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing may not, under any circumstances, overwrite express language in the contract in question. And the plaintiffs in this case seek to avoid the application of these well-established, straightforward rules by making three arguments, as I understand that. The first argument is that in the exercise of the redemption of the plaintiff's shares, some discretion was exercised. I suspect that they're relying on language in two cases that we find in Delaware law. There's Gale versus Brashad, which my colleague cited, and a second case called Immersale. And it's important for the court to understand what kinds of discretion are involved in those cases, because discretion isn't a buzzword. You don't simply get to just say it and ignore the principle. All executory agreements have decisions involved with respect to the execution of rights, and one could argue that any decision to exercise contractual rights involves discretion. That tells you nothing about how the case ought to be resolved. In the Gale case, which Mr. Walsh referred to, the discretion there was to set the price. The unilateral discretion was in the hands of the company to establish the exercise price. And what Gale said is if the company retains the unilateral discretion to determine the price or to determine whether the conditions of exercise have been met, then that discretion has to be exercised in good faith. Nowhere in Gale or in Immersole will you find the principle that the plaintiffs advocate here, which is that any time you make a decision, you're exercising discretion, and any such discretion is bounded by the covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
Well,
that would be
the
uniquely...
the practical effect here of the exercise of discretion was to set the price, wasn't it?
It was not, Your Honor. It was not. The price was set by contract, and I think it's an important distinction. I'm glad you asked it. The contract in this case, which is the shareholders' rights plan, which is part of the appendix in this place, has two very important provisions. The price for the exercise is established at book value pursuant to a formula that is set forth in the contract, and there is no allegation in this case that other than that formula was applied or that it was not applied properly.
Well, let's step back for a minute. Oh, excuse me.
I just wanted to add, but they knew by waiting that there would be a different price if they waited.
It wouldn't be a different book value. There would be a different price for the shares. But that's not setting the price. And I don't think there's any doubt, nor should the court be distracted. Chancellor Chandler said that the company exercised its option to redeem at a time of economic advantage. But what I think is important for the court and important in other cases is that's what options are about. If the court sets about the business of deciding whether a party to an option...
Excuse me. I think that, you know, the problem here is that although the contract gave the company the absolute right to redeem at book value, the question here is what book value? If the book value that we're talking about is before the closing of the deal with Carlyle, then it's X. But if the redemption comes after... and in this case, it would have been 4 months after when the redemption actually took place, or at least when the company had the right to redeem. It's 4X.
Correct.
Now, that has to be in a case where number one, there that is discretionary. That is, the company wasn't required to redeem in March. It could have waited until afterwards if it wanted to.
Correct.
And your response, that is your client's response, is yes, but the company is entitled, contractually entitled, to exercise at a point where it's advantageous.
Negotiated for that precise right.
But does the company have any advantage at all when it's about to be merged out of existence? Whose advantage are we talking about?
There are three advantages here that I'm grateful for the question, Your Honor, but let me say something preliminary to that. The plaintiffs say the company could have waited. Presumably they had the right not to exercise, although as a matter of policy, I don't think it's disputed they always did. Why would we wait for these retirees? What about the people who retired 6 months before them, or a year before that, or 2 years before that? They all know how many shares they had, and they all had a calculator.
But nobody knew 6 months before.
But in fact, they did, Your Honor.
Excuse me, let me finish my question.
I apologize.
Nobody knew 6 months before, presumably, that there would be a deal that would result in basically monetizing the hidden value of the company at 4 times book value. I mean, nobody knew that then.
With respect, that's not accurate.
And the company and the – all right, well, we can pick some other time. But the fact is nobody's brought a claim on their behalf. We only have two plaintiffs here.
And these plaintiffs are particularly frustrated because, as a matter of chronology, their claims get closer to the deal. But the people who retired 3 months before or 6 months before or a year before were still within the window of time in which they alleged everyone knew there was a deal. The knowledge about the deal and
had those people come forward the way these two plaintiffs did, then we have their claims before us as well.
You might as well, Your Honor. My point is that you have to draw a line somewhere, and the fact that somebody gets close to the line tells you that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing isn't a requirement that you be happy with the outcome. It is a requirement that you not undermine the benefit of the bargain. The benefit of the bargain here was that they got to hold the stock for 2 years, and gain the appreciation. And, Justice Jacobs, specifically to your question, the book value, you said the book value of the stock was known to be going up after the transaction, and that's an accurate statement. That is true in every year in the existence of Booz Allen, because the book value of the stock, by agreement, increases 10% every year. So the argument that but if you had rated, I would have made more.
The difference is that this is an end game, as opposing counsel pointed out. And the other, when the company would continue on, there would always be an advantage to the entity as such in timing when there would be a redemption.
Right.
Now there isn't.
The
company is just basically a passive vessel. And the decision really resides in somebody else.
No, I don't think that's accurate, Justice. And let me say a couple things about that. First, there is a premise in this case that at the end of March in 2008, everyone was certain that a transaction would be consummated at the end of July in 2008. Anybody who remembers 2008 can't have that certainty. We were in the height of the largest recession in the country's history at the time that this transaction was consummated. It's a miracle it was consummated. So the idea that people knew with a certainty that a transaction would be consummated is counterfactual, and I think counterhistorical.
That's an argument for a fact finder.
And that's why I need to get to my second point, because there's an assumption that if the company is going out of business or changing its formation, it should operate its business differently. I find that nowhere in the case law. But let me tell you three advantages.
What about Revlon?
Well, in this case, we're talking about the shareholders, and we're talking about whether or not there was any purpose in the redemption for the company at the end of this time. And let me give you three purposes that I think are evident without fact-finding.
Okay, and you're welcome to do that, but what I would like to hear is why, at a point at which all that's going to happen, assuming it's become absolutely certain, so we'll forget the argument that we don't know whether it'll happen or not, but as I understand it, at the point at which this transaction closes, whoever the stockholders are going to get a whole lot more money. And if these particular parties were allowed to participate, they would have shared in that additional sum of money. It would mean that the other stockholders would get a little bit less, true, but there would be one pie. It's distributed among all the people who have an interest in it. And, you know, why is that in any way similar to the normal circumstance where a company has an option to redeem and can pick the time that's most economically advantageous, because the company is moving forward, it's doing business, it's making profits, avoiding losses if possible. Here we have none of that involved. We have arguably a unique set of circumstances. The company is ending. Why doesn't that change the equation?
Well, I don't think it's unique at all, but some of it is in the nature of options. The world today is full of stock options. They exist everywhere. There are billions of them out there. If the court were to articulate a rule that says, we will now examine in your exercise of the option under the duty of good faith and fair dealing whether you had some purpose other than to maximize your economic advantage, you've told all option holders in the world what to plead, and that will be the job of courts, is to exercise to determine why you exercised that option at that time. I submit to you that options are different, and this principle of what was your purpose and what was the benefit to you of exercise other than economic advantage is limitless. There will be no way for the court to draw the next line when the next plaintiff comes in and says, if you had just waited, you know, it wouldn't have been that big a deal to wait. But
well,
I think the purpose is important.
Wait a second. What if the rule, if you will, were that, you know, the contract language controls with respect to an option and the right to redeem and so forth, except in circumstances where the company is going out of business?
The company's not going out of business. The shares were all being tendered, right?
All right.
The business today continues. I wouldn't want anybody to think that the business is not operating and thriving today. I guess my point about that is the following. All companies might engage in transformative transactions. All companies discuss it at various levels all of the time. The idea that they need to run the business for the benefit of the option holders or ignore contractual rights because the exercise of those rights might be displeasing to the rights holders is, to me, foreign to the law. But I do want to tell you the purposes that I think were important at the time of the exercise. I think there are three. One is the purpose that's always important. The cost of capital was enormous in these shares, and therefore the company routinely, with no exceptions that I'm aware, exercised on the two-year anniversary of those shares because the cost of capital was north of 20%, 10 times the market at that time. But there are two purposes that are important to the transaction. Justice Jacobs, you asked, you might think, apropos of your earlier questions, what difference would that make if there's a transformative transaction? If we had not redeemed Mr. Nemitz and Mr. Whitcamper's shares, what would we say to other retirees? There's no dispute in this case that Mr. Nemitz and Mr. Whitcamper made valuable contributions. I assume they would not dispute that many before them did as well. And so why would they be treated specially? Why would they get a special benefit and get to be a shareholder at the time of a transaction when no other retiree did? What would be the reason to bestow that
benefit? That may be. You know, that rationale may be a proper exercise of good faith judgment. But the point here is that that rationale is one that has to be explained to and used to persuade
only if
a fact finder.
Only if the court finds.
Excuse me, and not be disposed of as a matter of law and a motion to dismiss the complaint.
But to rule in that way, Your Honor, with respect, you would have to find that the duty of good faith and fair dealing can override the express terms of the agreement.
Do you?
Because this agreement.
Do you?
You do.
You know, our case law says that the implied covenant is best understood as a way of implying terms in the agreement whether employed to analyze unanticipated developments or to fill gaps in the contract's provision. If this transaction, which was, you admit was transformative, and which basically resulted in the company being merged out of existence and its other business transferred elsewhere, if that is not an unanticipated development, then what is?
I don't think it's unanticipated at all, but I think that has to do with the nature of options. When an option is not an agreement to exchange a bargain and we're all going to be happy at it. Options have winners and losers. When I enter into an option with someone else, here's the deal. I have a right to exercise this to my economic advantage and to your economic disadvantage, and the court, pursuant to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, will not revisit that bargain on the back end and say, you know, you should have thought of something else. And let me give you an example that might be more relevant. Imagine that Mr. Whitcamper, when he tendered his shares during the two-year period, imagine that we said in response to that, you know, what's your purpose? What's the real benefit? Do you really need that new car? Let's examine that. He might say, you know what? We've answered that question at the bargaining table. I have this right now. You have this right later in time. That's the deal. Courts will not question that deal. Let me say a word about Dunlop, though, because counsel relied on it, and I think it's relevant. In the Dunlop case, the court looked at the express terms of the agreement and at least implied that it could think of no legitimate business purpose for State Farm's refusal to approve the underlying settlement and allow the parties to attempt to plead a breach of the implied covenant in good faith and fair dealing. But the circumstances of that case were extraordinary. Because in the Dunlap case, the uninsured motorist fund is a creature of legislation. There is a significant underlying public policy with respect to the express provision. It wasn't really negotiated between the parties. In this case, in an option agreement, the terms are negotiated between the parties. And the unambiguous language of our option agreement says that Booz Allen can redeem at any time. The only reasonable reading of at any time wouldn't permit a court to come in and say, but not at this time, or not under these circumstances. Parties who enter into options take risks. They take the risk that it will be a bad deal for them. But the covenant of good faith and fair dealing is not a Band-Aid to remedy a bad deal. It is an interpretive device to help the court understand what the parties meant.
Okay.
But here we know what they meant.
Again, I'm having trouble with this concept. You say that options are to be exercised or not exercised, and it's not a question whether it's a good deal or a bad deal.
Correct.
I'm with you on that, okay? But we're talking about an option with the company, right?
That's correct.
So it could be good for the company, bad for the option holder, or vice versa, right?
Correct.
Now we've got a situation where the company has no interest. It's not good for the company or bad for the company because the company isn't going to exist anymore, right?
Wrong. I didn't mean to interrupt your question. Here's why that's not correct, and I keep distracting myself. There are three purposes why it was important to redeem. One,
no, no, answer my question. You know, you interrupted and said, no, I'm wrong. The company is not going to cease to exist. Explain that one to me.
I perhaps I misunderstood your question, Your Honor. I thought what your question was that the company had no interest in doing this because it would cease to exist, and that what I was attempting to suggest is that it has a compelling interest in doing this, whether or not it exists.
And the compelling interest is what?
Twofold. Equitable treatment of all retirees. In order to not redeem their shares, I think there's no escaping the fact that we would have to have treated Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper differently from all other retirees, bestowed upon them a special benefit. The company can be sued under such circumstances. And I think it's fair to say that had the company allowed $53 million of its shareholders' money by deciding not to redeem Mr. Nemec's and Mr. Whitcamper's shares to walk out the door, the current shareholders of the company would have filed a suit for what we'd be standing here today. Now, Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper wouldn't be standing here, but we'd be standing here today. And something Mr. Walsh said, I think, is informative here. He suggested that the business judgment rule, that you could go either way, and either decision would be governed by the business judgment rule. We don't think you reach the business judgment rule because we think the contract answers the question. But if you were to reach the business judgment rule, he would be right. You could go either way, and either decision would be protected by the business judgment rule. I see I only have a moment or two remaining. Let me speak, if I may, to what I believe is a misperception of the equities in this case. Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper are frustrated because they ceased to be shareholders at a time that was close to a transaction. The country is full of frustrated shareholders. I am myself, with respect to my Google shares, frustrated. But they are not different. There was no discrimination. Every former officer of Booz Allen who retired had their shares redeemed at the two-year anniversary. Every single one of them can today calculate how much more money they had made had they been shareholders at the time of the transaction. It is frustrating if you miss an airplane while you're standing in the gate, but you didn't miss it any differently than the guy who's sitting in the parking lot or the guy who's staying at home. They are not uniquely prejudiced here. In fact, they suffered no prejudice at all. They've gotten the benefit of the bargain. So the sense that I think drives the complaint and their frustration and that the Chancellor Chandler was sympathetic with is it would be frustrating to get this close. But from the company's perspective, there is no reason to treat Mr. Nemec or Mr. Whitcamper differently from anyone else. They applied the policy that they always applied. They weren't shareholders at the time of the transaction, and because they weren't shareholders, they didn't benefit in the transaction. That's not extraordinary in our commercial world. There are lots of people who wish they owned shares at the time of a deal. Were the court to suggest that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing ought to be implicated to reevaluate the purpose of the redemption of the shares, I submit to you that you are opening a door you will be unable to close, because in every case, every breach of contract case that comes to court has a disappointed party and one that thinks that the other side has acted unfairly. If the covenant of good faith and fair dealing becomes the grounds on which you can raise your hand and say not fair under these circumstances, then the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing will become the most important provision of every contract. And Delaware law is exactly the opposite. Delaware law is the express provisions of agreements control because we need the certainty associated with those express provisions. Unless the court has additional questions, I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me first address, Mr. Johnson has suggested there were benefits to the company. And if you think about this, in fact, it was economically disadvantageous to the company to redeem the shares. And the reason I say that is because, in essence, the company paid out $15 million to Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitcamper. What purpose did that serve of the company? The only thing it did was bring back and or take out of circulation their shares. It really goes to your question, which is, at the time the redemption occurred, everybody knew what the price was, so to speak. It was the price that, if you are a shareholder, you get to cash out at, essentially $700 in the Carlyle transaction. And so it simply wasn't a question of the price. The redemption was simply a question of who's going to be left standing at the end of the day to cash out big. And Mr. Johnson says, well, what about all the other retirees? There's nothing in the record that anybody else was similarly situated to Mr. Nemec and Mr. Whitkemper. And if they were, I suspect that they would be co-plaintiffs. They would have been in here saying, me too. But as far as we know, nobody was similarly situated. What makes these gentlemen's case very different is at the time the company redeemed them, they knew this was going to happen. In fact, the head of the company says it is an easy moral decision for you to participate. So you can't say, well, what about the people that retired 6 months ago? There were facts known to the company at the time they redeemed these people. And it came down to simply, are you in or are you out? And without any explanation as to why they were out, the company, and now it's the company did this, it's not the board, but under the agreements and under Delaware law, in a case like this, it's the board that should make a business decision about whether this is an appropriate redemption. And whether that was done or not done here, we don't know. What we do know is that the board stood to get $6 million by reason of the redemption decision, knowing the Carlyle transaction was going to happen.
You mean the members of the board in their capacity as shareholders?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And Mr. Nemec himself stood to gain $3 million alone by reason of being a participant. Your Honor, I just want to point out that in thinking about this case, the Revlon situation is a very good example because it shows that context means something, that duties can change when it's the end game, and that's exactly what it is here. I have no further
thing. We appreciate the arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.